Charles Lindbergh's solo transatlantic flight in 1927 is probably the only one most people remember today. But what about the aviators who flew before and after him, racing against each other and the technological limits of the time to complete record-breaking aeronautical feats? Joe Jackson has written about the men and women who also flew, what inspired them, and how everything changed in 1927 in his new book, Atlantic Fever, Lindbergh, His Competitors, and the Race to Cross the Atlantic. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Joe Jackson to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Now, you also have written a novel.
I've written a novel and 5 or 6 other nonfiction narratives.
Uh-huh. And this thing just grabbed you because...
It was, whenever I start a book, it usually has to do with an issue or an idea. And when I was thinking about my next book, it was 2008, and the presidential elections were going on, and the Beijing Summer Olympics were going on, and there was a lot of talk on programs like this, and, you know, in the news about whether or not the United States was the most competitive culture on Earth, and I found that fascinating, and I started thinking about doing something on one of the best-known races in the United States, and I didn't in the 20th century, and I didn't immediately think of what became known as the Great Atlantic Derby or the Ortig Prize, but when I fixated upon it, you could see that it became really very much about competition and celebrity.
So tell us about Raymond Ortig, who set in motion this sudden push to cross the Atlantic.
Well, he was a... he was born in France on the border between Spain and France. He was very poor. When he was young, his grandmother sewed some francs into his belt and said, go to New York and see what you can do. And he got a job as a waiter over at what was then the Lafayette Cafe at Washington Square. He stayed there for about 10 years, and he was successful enough that he was able to buy that cafe and the hotel that was associated with it, and another hotel with a partner called the Hotel Brevoort, and he turned it into what was considered an authentic piece of France in New York. During World War One, there were all of these French aviators and soldiers that would come over to the United States, and they would all stay in the Lafayette, and they would talk about home, and Ortig, of course, became homesick. And after the war was over, he missed that, and he was hosting a dinner for Eddie Rickenbacker, who was America's top ace. It was sponsored by the Aero Club of New York, just right outside of in Long Island. And Rickenbacker said, "I missed the camaraderie between the American and the French flyers, and I hope that someday aviation will bring our two great cultures together in peace instead of war." And he, and that night, Ortig joined the club, plopped down $25,000, and started the whole ball rolling.
And what year was that?
That was 1919.
So it took a long time for Lindbergh finally to actually make the solo flight,
right.
But others, of course, tried in different combinations. $25,000 was a lot of money, but it wasn't enough to actually even pay for putting a plane and an expedition together, was it?
Not really. The idea was that everybody pretty much knew. I saw a figure that $25,000 at one point during that period was worth about $300,000 to $350,000. But everybody pretty much knew that whoever made it across the Atlantic first was going to be worth a lot.
But this spurred them? Something had to get the ball rolling.
It was an inducement prize. You know, a lot of science is kind of comes forward because of inducement prizes. I mean, today, the private space race was given a kick in the pants by the X Prize. Mm-hmm. So it's not only just the amount of money that does it, but it's the excitement and the prestige of being first.
Well, Ortig first offered the prize in 1919, then again in 1924, but why didn't anyone finally attempt to make a transatlantic flight until 1926?
Because the technology was not really available until about 25, 26. What made it possible to fly across the Atlantic nonstop for 3,600 miles was the development of the air-cooled engine, those huge rotary engines that you can still see on crop dusters across the United States. The arms stick out. If you visualize it, you've probably seen it. The arms stick out like the arms of the legs of an octopus. You know, those are and they were very powerful. They were lighter than the old water-cooled engines.
I was made aware of just how important this sort of flight was while I was watching Jean Renoir's great film, Rules of the Game, which starts off with a French aviator, having made a successful flight and being hailed as a hero. We tend to think of this very much in American terms, Charles Lindbergh. But this was really an important thing for the French, wasn't it?
Oh, it was very much so. And the French saw themselves as an air-minded nation. I mean, they had been, when you think about it, they were really the first aloft. The Montgolfier brothers were the first to go aloft in hot air balloons. And everybody was surprised that it would be a couple of bicycle makers from Ohio that invented the plane. The French designers were far ahead of Americans. They created wind tunnels long before the Americans did. So they were light years ahead of Americans as far as technology went.
And they had some heroes, people whose names are not known here. Nungesser and François Colli and René Fonck still be known in France?
I think so. In fact, there have been some films about Nungesser, and there has been some interesting discoveries about whether or not, by French researchers, about whether or not Nungesser and Colli actually made it across. They seem to have... There was a lot of talk about the fact up in Newfoundland that people saw their plane when they made it across. They just disappeared when they took off on May 8th. But they seem to have made it across the Atlantic, and they went down somewhere between Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. And they may have been shot down by a rum boat, a rum runner's boat. And so they were victims of prohibition rather than natural forces.
So we don't know whether the French actually were the first to make the transatlantic flight. Would it have been better to go from France to North America rather than the other way around? The prevailing winds make it easier to go east, don't they?
It makes it all of the winds flow from the United States over to the continent. So you always have a tailwind that pushes you along. So you're faster. And you use less gasoline. If you're going from Paris to New York, you're always pushing against a headwind and you're using up gas. So it's harder.
Now, Fonck left before Lindbergh.
He did. Everybody thought this was in September 1926. He was the French ace of aces. Everybody thought that his planned flight was the sure thing. He had a American co-pilot, a Russian mechanic, and a French radio operator on board, and his plane was designed by Igor Sikorsky, who we know over here as the developer of the helicopter. But it was, you know, the most technologically advanced plane at the time.
But too much weight made it a problem. Didn't they figure that out before they tried to take off with all those people?
Well, there was this one scene. Fonck was very worried. I mean, people were... This was also a diplomatic event. So people were loading the people who were behind the flight were loading the cockpit up with food to be eaten in France, with chairs that officials would sit at. I mean, it just became crazy at the end.
So why didn't Fonck try again, the same plane but with fewer people?
Because nobody really... By then, the momentum had started with other people, and because he had crashed, nobody really trusted him.
And most of this work was being done either on the American East Coast or in France.
Right.
Lindbergh comes out of the West, doesn't he?
Yes, and that's what's really interesting, because Lindbergh was the only one who decided that he wanted to fly alone. And Lindbergh was always very cognizant and very swayed by his peers. If he'd been over on the East Coast, he had gotten the plane that he originally wanted, which was a two-seater, he might very well have flown with somebody else. But he was on the West Coast. He was separated by a continent, and by the time he flew over to New York, he had built a one-seater plane, and his plans were too far ahead that he couldn't change it.
My guest is Joe Jackson. He's written a book called Atlantic Fever, Lindbergh, His Competitors, and the Race to Cross the Atlantic. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Richard Byrd was an American top contender for the Ortec Prize. He had fought in World War One, hadn't he?
No, he had. He was slightly too young, and he had injuries. And he also was a bit of an organizational genius, and so the Navy put him in charge of naval flight bases in Canada and the United States.
He's known as the first man to fly over both the North and South Poles.
Right.
Did he complete those expeditions before he attempted to cross the Atlantic?
He completed the North Pole expedition. It was in 1926 that occurred.
You write about how the main Ortec Prize contenders were written about and publicized during the height of their fame. Were all these people treated like heroes?
Everyone. And that's what's so interesting about that. I mean, when you read the histories these days, it's history written from the viewpoint of the victor, and so it usually seems that Lindbergh was foreordained to be the winner, but every one of these guys at some point was seen by the press as being a front runner. Everyone was a front runner at some point, and everyone was thought capable of winning.
And I would have thought that flying a bigger, sturdier plane would have been the best idea, as long as you didn't load it down with an awful lot of food and stuff.
That was the prevailing idea, because basically it was felt, I mean, they believed in redundancy. If one engine went out, then you at least had two others to go on.
I still like that idea.
Yeah. And NASA, my dad was with NASA, and they believed in redundancy too. And that was really kind of a Navy idea. Most of these flyers were Navy flyers from Pensacola, and they drilled that into them, I think.
The makers of the planes became celebrities as well.
They did, and what's interesting is the makers, almost every one of the makers of the planes was a recent immigrant to America.
Fokker had built planes for the German war effort during World War One, and then he came here?
Right, he came.
Is that like Wernher von Braun?
Well, he wasn't kidnapped. It was a little bit different, but I mean, he opened his factory in the Netherlands for about a year, and then he came over to the United States a year later. Igor Sikorsky was running. He was the top plane maker for the Tsar during World War One, but then he had to flee the revolution. And Giuseppe Bianca, who was the other famous immigrant designer, he had escaped from poverty in Sicily.
Now, was the problem with the larger planes simply a matter of weight? What about the ground effect?
Well, that's interesting. They didn't understand the ground effect. The race really changed when this one flyer out of Utah, he was a Mormon naval commander by the name of Noel Davis. He was probably the smartest man in the race, and he had calculated the stress per square foot on the wings of his huge plane, and he felt that his plane could take off. However, they did not really understand the ground effect, and they did not understand that when you're taking off up to a certain point, usually the length of the wings, both wings from the ground, then everything is smooth sailing. But once you get above that, you need extra thrust to get over that, especially if you're heavily laden. And these heavily laden planes just could not could not overcome the ground effect.
Is this the same thing as gravity? Or
it's like gravity in a way, but it also has very much to do with the aerodynamics of airflow and the air under the wings and that kind of thrust.
There are a lot of other people who I never heard of who were important to this story. Charles Levine, a key financial backer in the Atlantic race for a number of flyers, a man who seems to be universally disliked. Was he just unpleasant?
Levine was really interesting. He was cast as the villain of the piece. He was the only pure New Yorker. Everybody else was kind of transplants, but he was the one who owned the plane that Lindbergh wanted. This Blanca, it was called the Columbia.
It would have been ironic for a Jewish financial supporter to have helped Lindbergh, who later became a friend of Hitler's.
But what's interesting is there is absolutely – I went through all what letters of Lindbergh's still exist from that period, and also accounts of people who flew with Lindbergh. And none of them say anything about any sort of anti-Semitism. What happens, though, is that Lindbergh wanted the plane that Levine owned, and Levine offered it to Lindbergh, but on the grounds that they could pick the pilot. And Lindbergh was extremely bitter about that.
Now, you give some details about the first women to attempt to fly the Atlantic, but you don't mention Amelia Earhart.
That's because it didn't occur within the course of this 1926-1927 flying season.
But Ruth Elder.
Ruth Elder, Frances Grayson, the flying princess from England. Ruth Elder was the only one of the women who flew immediately after Lindbergh took off to actually survive. And she said up front when she was a dental hygienist down in Florida that she was going to fly to become famous and make money, and she did. She did quite well.
So these people are all famous. In doing research for this book, you probably just had to open up a lot of old newspapers.
Old newspapers. I had to go into old archives for the main flyers, for Chamberlain and for Byrd and for Lindbergh in order to get their personalities.
Joe Jackson is the author of 5 works of nonfiction, 1 novel, his latest, Atlantic Fever, Lindbergh, His Competitors, and the Race to Cross the Atlantic, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.